doing some disaster preparedness
for the European economy.
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, June 12th.
Coming up, the hard truth about the Great Recession.
Plus, robots ate my stock market.
And making your bed the easy way.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
With 5 days to go before voters in Greece decide on a new government, there's an acknowledgement today that there's planning going on in case Greece has to leave the euro. A European Commission spokesman says scenarios are being discussed, but there are no hard plans. This also must be happening within companies. Michael Heise is chief economist of Allianz, a German-based financial services company. Dr. Heise, good morning.
Good morning.
I remember we would telephone people and ask if they're making contingency plans should Greece leave the eurozone. Unthinkable, they would say, no contingency plans. Is that changing, do you think?
It definitely is changing. I think any company needs to think about this scenario of Greece exiting the eurozone. Personally, I don't think that the likelihood is very big. I would say maybe around 20-30%, but definitely high enough to warrant a plan how to deal with this possible currency exchange.
I mean, if you think about it, you actually work for a company that does a lot of work in the insurance field, and if there were a 20 or 30% possibility of something bad happening, you might take out insurance against it.
Definitely. Every company has to find a way to minimize, of course, the possible losses or damage caused by such an exit. This, for a financial company like ours, both sides of the balance sheet would be exchanged into a new currency, so there is no huge mismatch.
You want it to affect both of those assets and liabilities in a similar way.
Oh, yes. But of course, any currency exit of Greece would probably cause some recessionary momentum in the economy. And basically, this is also the reason why we do not advise the EU nor Greece to actually do this kind of exit. It would be a very painful thing to do.
Is it actually something that companies could hedge against, or is it fundamentally something that's just quite unpredictable?
I think there is basically no possibility for hedging against it. It's basically an exchange with a lot of risks, which you actually can't hedge against.
Michael Heise is chief economist at Allianz. He spoke to us from Munich. Dr. Heise, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Disclosure, Allianz is one of the underwriters of this program.
Well, for a Greek perspective on the Europe story now, we're joined by Dimitris Doulos. He's an economist at the American College of Greece outside Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
You are an economics professor. You speak to economics students. How do you tell them that Greece got into this position? And how will you teach about avoiding situations like this years from now?
Oh, I have been saying that we are going to reach this point for the last 10 years because it was something that every economist could see. We were a country that we produced less than we consumed. It's also a social problem. From a country that used to work hard, we have become a country of public servants and a private sector that depends a lot on the state. So to preserve such a large state, and you have to pay a lot of taxes, and that creates excessive spending, and that creates deficits and debt. And tax evasion, by the way, is another very important problem in Greece.
Well, how do you fix that problem? I mean, you've got a lot of people working there who aren't paying any taxes at all.
I would call the IRS, to be honest with you, and fix it. That's the best way to do it, because there's no political willingness to do it. Only those that are on pension or on salaries pay taxes, and nobody did anything because they did not want to take the political risk to do something.
Do you think that the United States and the other power centers in Europe have done a good job handling the Greek crisis from the outside?
Well, I don't think that the U.S. can do a lot about it, but at least President Obama is giving some advice and encourages the Europeans to take quick action. And the U.S. example in the recent crisis, the quick reaction of the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve are very good examples. Instead, the Europeans, they did not react quickly, and they just let the problem grow and grow, with Germany, you know, being probably the reason, and that is why we reached at this point.
Let me ask you one final thing. We've got this big election coming up this weekend. Are you scared?
Yes. Yes, I am. But despite what the left-wing party is saying, I don't think that they can do what they are saying they will do when they come to power. They don't have a lot of choice. I think they will realize the consequences of what they are planning to do, and they will back down, how you say. I mean, they are not going to do it.
Professor Dimitris Doulos is an economics professor at the American College of Greece. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
In the U.S., the index of small business optimism is out, and small businesses are feeling a little bit less that way. The National Federation of Independent Businesses says its index fell by 0.1% last month.
For more on that story, let's bring in Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, I guess it's not a big surprise that small businesses are a little less optimistic given everything that's happening in the economy, but what's your take on that?
Well, small business owners are really headline-driven and talk-show-influenced. There is a survivor's bias now. Many of the small businesses have folded, but those who did not have to close their doors are now seeing a pickup in business. It's not robust, but it's real nonetheless. They don't really hire until they desperately need help when they see a real recovery in their business. But they are starting to hire. They're talking about taxes and regulation and everything, but they hire when business is actually picking up, and that's what they're seeing now.
So you're saying that they're looking at the news headlines and they're seeing some bad headlines out there from Europe and elsewhere. But when you look at their bottom lines, they're not quite as bad as it may seem.
Bottom line, money talks.
Well, let me get your thoughts on another big story, Julie. The Fed says that the median net worth of the American household has fallen 40% during the Great Recession. It's just a stunning number.
Well, it means about 70% of us in the middle class have seen their net worth destroyed after 18 years of gains. You're looking at about a 43% dive due to housing values, first of all, falling year after year for the last 5 years. And unfortunately, it's likely to remain very sluggish for years to come. Prices can't go back to 2006 levels because those prices were wildly speculative and basically in a bubble. Consumers really believe the monstrous banking myth of the home equity loan. Unleash that pent-up value in your ever-increasing home and borrow on fictitious property values. And they spent like crazy on toys, games, and prizes. Then they also saw their retirement investment income collapse as well. Incomes, they dropped a third year in a row. Adjusted for inflation, we're back to 1996 levels. And the 2000 boom is totally busted.
Julie Neiman, analyst at Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, let's get some more now on that Federal Reserve story we were just talking about with Julie. The Fed said that the median net worth of the American household is down 40% since 2007, as we mentioned. But it's worth noting that our net worth is not the same as our income, as Marketplace's Eve Troeh reports.
Your income is basically your paycheck. That affects daily life, the groceries you buy, or whether you go see a movie. Net worth is the value of your assets, house, investment, savings, minus debt. That impacts longer-term choices. MIT management professor Tom Cohen says when net worth tumbles,
people are stuck in one place. They can't move to take a better job. They can't sell their house.
He says net worth tanked more than income because this recession was rooted in real estate. Inflated home values made people feel and act richer than they were, says Greg McBride at Bankrate.com.
There were a lot of people that were leaning against the crutch of credit to support a lifestyle that their income could not.
He says families have eased up on debt. They've had to, as lenders don't make loans based on net worth like they used to. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Machines, they do such a good job cleaning your dishes or drying your clothes. But what about running your stock market? Scott Patterson says Wall Street has been taken over by computer-driven artificial intelligence programs, technology that has left regulators mystified about what's going on. His new book out today is called Dark Pools: High-Speed Traders, AI Bandits, and the Threat to the Global Financial System. Good morning, Mr. Patterson.
Good morning to you, David.
Help me understand your thesis here. Something like robots ate my stock market?
Right. Well, this has been a dramatic revolution in the stock market that's happened over the past 10 to 15 years. People actually have no idea. I didn't have any idea a couple years ago until I started diving into this issue as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Something like 70 to 80% is controlled by robots. And the problem with that is you'd think that they would act perfectly rational, but sometimes they just completely fly off the tracks, as we saw on May 6, 2010, the flash crash when the market crashed about 10% due to glitches in computer systems across the country.
You also talk about 10% of the stock market takes place in what some are calling dark pools. What are those? I mean, I know it's hard to see in a dark pool. I guess the implication there.
Right. Well, the issue is that investors are increasingly fleeing the stock market because of the action of these robots on the stock markets. They're trying to hide in dark pools, which are basically private venues where buy and sell orders match up away from the public markets. They're also infested with robots. So there's really no place to hide anymore. It's just completely been taken over by robots. And I really think there's no turning back. The issue is the regulators need to get a hold of what's going on.
Now, it is fair to say, though, Scott, that financial markets had the ability to go out of whack in the pre-robot days. I mean, the 1929, not a lot of robots at work, but we can get ahead of ourselves and things can collapse.
Yeah, and there was Black Monday in 1987 when the market saw its biggest one-day collapse of all time. But, of course, there's always going to be market disruptions. What we're seeing now is a very new kind of market disruption that potentially could spread to all sorts of assets, not just stocks, but futures market or the options market or the currency market.
So you don't think there's any way to boot the robots out of this process, but you think more oversight is what's in order?
Right. Well, I think investors feel like things have changed so dramatically. There's nobody really in control of it. And unless they get that faith in the market back, they're not going to come back to the market. And that's a big problem.
The new book is called Dark Pools, High-Speed Traders, AI Bandits, and the Threat to the Global Financial System. Scott Patterson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For decades, the U.S. has been trying to persuade China to raise the value of its currency, arguing a lower yuan makes Chinese goods cheaper over here and hurts the trade deficit. It's going to be a lot harder to make that case, though, after a policy change at the International Monetary Fund. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
The IMF used to say China's yuan was substantially undervalued, but in the last couple years, the currency has strengthened against the dollar by about 7%. So now the IMF says the yuan is only moderately undervalued. Clyde Prestowitz at the Economic Strategy Institute says that hurts the American argument.
In principle, it shouldn't, but in terms of public relations, of course it does, because it then looks like the U.S. is beating up on the Chinese.
Prestowitz says China's currency remains significantly cheaper than the dollar, causing a persistent trade imbalance.
The currency distortion effectively acts like a tariff on U.S. exports and a subsidy to U.S. imports. So it's kind of a double whammy.
As for the yuan's recent strength, Kelly Dry trade advisor Greg Mastel isn't impressed.
It has appreciated moderately. It started from a relatively very low level. And I think there's still good evidence that it's significantly undervalued.
He says Beijing bureaucrats, not markets, continue to set the Chinese currency's value. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Ahead of the General Motors shareholder meeting in Detroit today, the company's CEO is saying it's time for the government to decide what it wants to do with all the stock it acquired when it bailed out the company. The carmaker's stock price has been sagging in spite of its solid profits lately. Some analysts say that has something to do with the government's position. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
Morningstar's David Whiston has been keeping a close watch on the presidential campaign for signs of when the government might unload its remaining 32% stake in General Motors. It still holds 500 million shares as part of the deal that saved the carmaker. Whiston thinks the uncertainty over the timing of that sale is keeping GM stock artificially low.
You're talking about a tremendous amount of shares that could potentially be dumped on the market at once, and it's just a reason for investors to look elsewhere.
Republican Mitt Romney has been pressing for a quick exit by the government, and for a while, Whiston thought that might happen. But now he doubts the Obama administration would sell for a big loss to taxpayers, at least not at this point.
If they wait till after the election, and hypothetically if Obama were to win, they can sell the shares and take the bad publicity then without costing them the election.
As for GM, spokesman Jim Kane says it'll be a great day when the government does decide to wind down its stake, but for now the company's just focused on making the best cars it can.
The question of government ownership isn't something we can control, so we don't try to.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
How would you like to skip traffic on your way to work and also be paid for it? Well, a new project out of Stanford and backed by the U.S. Department of Transportation is experimenting with just that in an effort to reduce city congestion. The program works by giving drivers that commute during off-peak times a chance to win up to $50 added to their paycheck.
Joining us today in our Midday Extra is transportation economist Charles Kamenoff. Good morning, Mr. Kamenoff.
Hi.
What do you make of this idea of essentially setting up a lottery to persuade people to vary the time they go in and come home?
I think it's great for research purposes to be able to see how much money it's going to take for drivers to change their behavior. But I don't see it as being sustaining because where is the money going to come from to offer a lottery payment to thousands of drivers? I don't see it working.
Well, and also, do people have the choice of when they're going to commute? Often it's just set by where you're working and what time you have to be there.
Well, there's actually a lot more choice in travel than we sometimes imagine. And as the backers of this new idea point out, and I think they're right, it wouldn't take everybody changing behavior. Sometimes it only takes a fraction to make the highways flow more smoothly for everybody else. So in principle, the idea of using incentives to change travel behavior is a very good one, but there still has to be a source for the money.
Well, you're a traffic economist. What's the best idea you've seen to get traffic down?
You know, I hate to say it because politically it's had a rough go, at least here in the United States, not in other places, but congestion pricing, the idea of charging drivers a pretty hefty fee to drive into the crowded heart of their city or metropolitan area, and then using the revenue to improve public transportation so that you're providing alternatives, that's a proven winner. It's been proven in Singapore, in London, and in Stockholm. We're trying to get it here in New York City, and once we do, I think that it's going to spread like wildfire to other parts of the United States.
In New York City, of course, public officials, including the current mayor, have pushed for it. It's a tough political sell, as you acknowledge.
Well, you know, it's funny because that New York Times article that broke the story on this lottery scheme, it said that drivers hate congestion pricing. And I think that's an oversimplification. They hate it until it's put into place. And then many of them become believers in it because it saves them time, and time is money.
But just so I understand your sense of congestion charges, you've seen data perhaps from Europe that once it's in force, people say, oh, I don't have to go into the city core all the time. I'm willing to pay a lot of money to do so because it'll be a lot shorter trip?
Not only will the trip be shorter, but its duration will be more predictable. You know, one of the problems with traffic is that if you've got to get somewhere on time, you know, to a job interview or an important meeting or a medical appointment, traffic is now so unpredictable because of congestion that you've got to allow more time than is really optimal for you. And with a congestion charge, maybe depending upon the level of the charge, 10 or 20% of the trips disappear. They move to other ways of getting around or other times of the day. And the remaining 80 to 90% of trips are done not only faster, but more predictably.
Charles Kamenoff is a transportation economist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Some banks are not being fair to consumers when it comes to checking accounts. That's according to new research by the Pew Charitable Trust, which says, among other things, overdraft fees are still too high. For our new segment, Money Matters, we're joined by Tess Vigeland, who hosts our consumer finance show, Marketplace Money. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Tess, I thought that this whole issue of overdraft fees was taken care of in the new Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. What's the deal?
Yeah, you know, we thought a lot of things were fixed there, but apparently checking accounts weren't one of them. They're way too confusing for so many consumers now. Do you know how many pages the average disclosure form is? Take a guess.
Oh, boy, like 5 pages?
Try 69. 69 pages
wow.
For a checking account, Jeremy. And that really gets consumers so confused that then they end up falling into overdraft territory. They don't know how. They don't know why. So this report is recommending that banks really simplify these disclosure forms like they've done for so many other things. Now let's do it for checking accounts.
Well, but I can hear the other side saying, look, why should consumer banking be totally risk-free? Shouldn't banks be able to charge people when they don't have the money that they are trying to spend?
Well, and it's a good point, and there's, you know, all kinds of cases for personal responsibility here. But the banks, you know, they're trying to come up with all kinds of fees because so many of those fees have been tamped down on recently.
Right.
But there is a difference between making money for providing a service and sneaking these fees in on people who don't know that they're coming. You know, for example, if you cash checks out of chronological order, that pushes you into having to pay multiple overdraft charges. And people just don't realize that this is happening.
Well, now we have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Are they going to do anything about this?
Well, we called the agency up. They didn't have any comment, but they have been looking at checking accounts for a while now. Back in March, they asked for comments on checking accounts and also on overdrafts from consumers. So if you have something to say, give them a holler. And we know they're compiling a bunch of data in advance of putting out some kind of report.
Tess Vigeland of our weekend consumer finance show, Marketplace Money. Thanks a lot, Tess.
Thanks, Jeremy.
The Oklahoma City Thunder and the Miami Heat go at it in game one of the NBA Finals tonight. The matchup between two of basketball's biggest stars, LeBron James and Kevin Durant, should further boost ratings at ESPN and ABC. Despite warnings of a hangover from last year's players' lockout, NBA viewership is actually up, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Fans seem to have forgotten all about the lockout that shortened the NBA season by 240 games. Brad Adgate with Horizon Media says regular season ratings for games on ESPN, ABC, and TNT were up 2% compared to last year. Saturday night's conference final between Miami and Boston was the most watched NBA game ever on cable.
There's a lot of drama and a lot of close games, and I think that really heightens up fan interest.
Drama, like the young Philadelphia 76ers team that made it much further than expected, and of course the Jeremy Lin phenomenon early this year. Kenneth Shropshire teaches the business of sports at the Wharton School. He says the jump in ratings should help the network sell ads next season.
It's tough to make up for the past, but I think for the future, especially after we get through this final series, they may have a much better story to sell.
That story stars a lucrative and hard-to-reach demographic of young men. Adgate says the median age of NBA viewers is around 38, younger than a typical sports audience. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
About the same number of people steal the popular HBO series Game of Thrones by swiping it online as Watch It Legit via cable TV subscription. That according to the online news site Torrent Freak. Fans have been offering to pay HBO if it were to start some online-only video service. One guy started a petition. But HBO sees subscription cable TV as its lifeblood. And it turns out Australians are especially into pirating the show, in part because episodes get to TVs down under one painfully long week after they premiere in the United States.
Well, finally, David, to Spain, where a company has developed a smart bed that makes itself.
Like you press a button or something?
You press a button. You don't have to make your bed. You don't have to pull the sheets up. You don't have to fluff the pillows. It does all that for you. It turns a messy bed into a perfectly made bed in about 50 seconds. There is no word yet on how much it will cost or how soon I can get one. And probably every child in the world whose parents are always telling them to make their bed.
If you're first in line, my son Nick is second in line.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.